Our first guest is Scott Kellogg, educational director of the Radix Ecological Sustainability Center and Urban Environmental Educational Center in Albany.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So first of all, I guess, could you just tell us a little bit about the Radix Center and what you do there and what they do in general?
Sure. Radix is an urban environmental education center. We run a demonstration site of sustainable tools and technologies on a one-acre farm in the middle of Albany that are designed to teach urban residents with a special focus on youth how to have more local access and control over essential resources like food and water and waste management, energy production, with a strong emphasis on designing systems that are simple and affordable, with the goal of coming up with a model that we can copy in cities throughout the country and the world. So, a lot of different programs, bringing in kids and school groups, teaching ecological literacy. We run a farmer's market with A Village, which is another local organization, do a lot of environmental justice work more broadly. So, work and advocacy all across the board.
Wow. So as educational director in particular, what is it that you personally are up to?
So part of my responsibilities include bringing in organizing trips with school groups. We work pretty closely with Giffen Elementary School, which is a public elementary school around the corner from us. And we do programs in the school during the winter months and during the warmer months of the year, bring students around the corner where they're engaged in all different aspects of learning. And of course, school groups, we really say pre-K to PhD all around.
Wow.
Bringing folks in and letting them have some hands-on familiarity with the different sustainability systems that we have there, everything from, you know, picking up a chicken to engaging with a fish in an aquaponic system, to learning about bees, to learning about composting, renewable energy, rainwater harvesting, and really just trying to, you know, have them develop some basic familiarity with these systems that, you know, our survival is dependent upon, but many times as a consequence of living in cities, we tend to be disconnected from that, where our food comes from, where our water comes from, how energy is produced, and how wastes are processed. So, you know, really just trying to demonstrate how it makes sense integrated in high-density urban mosaic.
I understand you were the co-author of the book Toolbox for Sustainable City Living. A do-it-yourself guy. What is the goal of the book? Can you tell us about it?
Sure. Toolbox for Sustainable City Living was a book that came out in 2008 with South End Press. And basically what that was a collection of simple tools and designs and DIY how-tos that we had learned really from the 9 years spent at the organization we had previous to Radix, which was called the Rhizome Collective, that was in Austin, Texas. And we really wanted to compile all that knowledge into a book format. It was illustrated by a friend of mine named Juan Martinez, using lots of illustrations and animals and ants to sort of step into the role of anthropomorphized animal as an ants to demonstrate how to do everything from build rain catching systems to making mushroom logs to, you know, filtering waste oil to power vehicles to sort of more, you know, theoretical and philosophical conversations about what sustainability is and what does it mean when it is integrated with issues of social justice and equity and access.
Wow, that sounds like so fascinating. Could you describe a little bit about, I mean, maybe even go back further than that organization in Phoenix or in
Austin,
yeah. How you got involved in environmental science and in food production and all this kind of stuff?
I think for me, I really came to a lot of this work in sustainability advocacy through activism in general, and was involved in a number of movements prior to that in the 90s, everything from, you know, food not bombs to homes not jails, which were really eye-opening in their ability to try and address the root causes of social problems in our society rather than just looking at their symptomatic expressions, but looking at problems with food distribution and hunger and access to food and likewise access to affordable housing. So, you know, that led to a lot of involvement with the then nascent Alter Globalization movement of the late 1990s that was, you know, critical of the policies of organizations like the World Trade Organization and the IMF and the World Bank. And, you know, a catchphrase of that movement was another world is possible. And we would say this all the time, but I didn't feel like too many of us really knew what that other world actually looked like. You know, how do we eat in that other world? How are we going to get around in that other world? How are we going to take care of education? How are we going to provide for ourselves? So that's what really was the impetus for the creation of Rhizome, which was a bunch of us getting together and saying, let's take a space, in that case, a warehouse, and convert it into an environment that can answer some of those questions. And so we, you know, incorporated gardens and rain collection systems and composting toilets and gray water systems into the same space where we were providing low rent space to a number of different social and activist organizations, everything from, again, Food Not Bombs to independent media to Books for Prisoners program to Bikes Across Borders. And really, by having those social and ecological justice movements, organizations under the same roof, we were trying to explicitly draw the connections between them and show that those movements are necessarily interconnected, which is contrary to what I think you were and still are largely told in a lot of activist circles, is that you have to kind of choose one over the other.
So you see a relationship then between people growing their own food in their own neighborhood and being critical of international finance.
Absolutely. These are all socio-ecological systems, and we need to be thinking about how they play out on a local level, but also on a macro level, on a global scale as well. And so I think it's a really important skill to sort of be able to develop the kind of mental dexterity, so to say, to be able to think on a multi-scalar level, to be thinking about what it's like in your own backyard or your own neighborhood, in your own community, your school, and then, you know, of course, on a statewide level and a nationwide level, and then stepping outside of that onto what's going on in around the world and other nations as well.
And you're also getting your PhD in science and technology at RPI. Can you explain how that connects with the work you're doing?
Sure. So I'm a fourth year student in the Science and Technology Studies program at RPI, and Science and Technology Studies is a discipline. It's actually a subdiscipline of anthropology that's really looking at how scientific knowledge is produced and for whom. That's basically a good way to summarize it. But, you know, being honest about the fact that scientific knowledge is not produced in a vacuum, that there are social, political, economic factors that go into producing science.
And where funding comes from? Is that what you're
exactly
talking?
Where funding comes from, and or what are even the subconscious biases that scientists have, and who's funding studies, and then how those reports are being presented, and who's calling themselves an expert and who's calling themselves a layperson. Those are all questions, among with the many other, that are all central to STS. And it definitely crosses over into areas of ecology and agriculture, and particularly education, and in my case, environmental education. So I'm really basing a lot of my research around this concept, what I call urban ecosystem justice, which is a way to basically talk about urban complexity in its ecological, economic, and social, and cultural, and political senses. In such a way where we can, you know, really ask, how do questions of justice and equity apply to things like soils in cities, or the non-human life in cities, or the water, or the atmospheres around us? And that's basically the gist of it.
I wonder if maybe you could speak to that as someone who works in Albany and goes to RPI on a local level, what the specific problems of in Albany and Troy as far as food production and soil quality are.
Yeah, well, they're pretty substantial. I mean, both Albany and Troy are very much what we would call really textbook cases of what we call food deserts, or which is basically the definition of that is a community where there is limited to no access to fresh and nutritious, affordable, and culturally appropriate foods. Troy is a more egregious example of that. In Albany, we're actually lucky enough to have a Price Chopper, downtown. Troy, if you don't have a car, there's nowhere to get food here. You know, the Price Chopper is way out in Route 7, so if you don't have a car or are able to afford to take a cab out there, it's going to be pretty difficult to get on a bus and go out there, especially if you have kids and bring home your groceries. So it's you know, it's a problem of access. It's a problem also of just, and it's not enough just to bring food into the middle of the city. I mean, we can have a farmer's market, but if people can't afford the food that's being sold there, it doesn't really do much to remedy that. So it's a big systemic issue, and of course, no single intervention is going to be adequate in addressing it, but we really need to be working collectively around it to try and come up with a systemic solution to it. So, you know, that's one of the big problems. Urban agriculture is one of many ways to possibly address that, of trying to actually just grow food locally in the spaces that we have. And one, what I see an advantage, potential advantage to smaller and possibly shrinking cities like Albany and Troy, is that there is an abundance of vacant parcels that can potentially be used for food production. And that doesn't mean that it's always going to be straightforward and easy and that there's not problems, and we can talk about that. But you don't have quite the same problems you would, for instance, in a city like New York City, where there's tremendous downward real estate pressure and people are really forced to make a choice between using land for food production or for affordable housing. An advantage of places like Troy is that you have an abundance of both, honestly, and it doesn't necessarily have to be this either or choice, and we can work proactively for both at the same time.
Yeah, I think that's just about all the time we have for this segment. Is there anything, any last words you'd like to add before you go?
Be great if anybody wants to come and visit the Radix Center. You can come see our greenhouse, come see our systems. We maintain green growing conditions throughout the year. So if it's the middle of bleak December and you feel like seeing some green growing plants, come on down. We do open houses and tours the last Sunday of every month at 1 o'clock.
What's the address?
The address is 153 Grant Street. It's right at the corner of Grand Street and Warren Street in the south end of Albany.
Cool, thanks, and we hope to have you on again soon.
Thank you.